The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hi, everybody. I'm Fran Spielman. My guest this week is former Chicago, Philadelphia, and New Orleans school CEO, former city budget director, former city revenue director, former mayoral challenger, former Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, Paul Vallis. Wow, you're all of those things, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
That means I'm old.
I know the same feeling. I talked about all the formers in your resume, Paul, but let's talk about the current. You were and are a lead negotiator, unpaid, for the Fraternal Order of Police, who helped to finally bring home and end one of the longest contract stalemates in the history of Chicago. There is a tentative 8-year agreement with the Fraternal Order of Police. It will give rank and file police officers who have waited 4 long years for a pay raise, a 20% increase over 8 years, 22% compounded. Mm-hmm. What the heck took so long?
You know, that's a good question. I'll tell you just my observations, because obviously the mayor walked into this. I mean, this was a negotiation. This delay began during the Emanuel administration. A lot of people will say it's because the city was demanding greater accountability. You know, during the negotiations, I didn't see accountability as being a major issue. I always felt that the delays were more financial. I think the city has had a tendency, and having been budget director in the early 1990s, the city has always had a habit of delaying contract settlements in order to help balance their budgets, just as they've a lot of times not filled vacancies in order to help balance the budgets. And given the fact that the police department has the largest budget in the corporate fund, there's been this tendency to do both. They've also had a tendency to do it with respects to fire too. I remember in 1993, when I became budget director, there were like 1,500 police vacancies that had not been filled. And in effect, they were balancing their budget every year by simply not filling those vacancies. So I think a lot of it has been financial, because obviously, as you know, during the Emanuel administration, he was wrestling with serious financial issues that obviously he didn't address and that he passed on to Mayor Lightfoot. So I think that has a lot to do with it. A lot of people will say it's because the police were resisting accountability. I say in a big part of that was financial, the city wanting to sit on the money, the city wanting to balance its budgets by not filling vacancies and by delaying contract settlements.
Which begs the question how they're going to pay for this. The contract calls for this big, fat, retroactive paycheck, rightfully so, because they've been waiting 4 years. It costs $365 million. Going forward, that will cost $235 million, and the city has to account for that ongoing expense. How are they going to do that? They're talking about refinancing and using the savings at lower interest rates to pay for that. Is that a sound financial practice? What will they have to do to pay for this contract?
Well, let me point out that clearly, had there not been a COVID settlement, everybody would have been in trouble. You know, I mean, the massive COVID settlement has bailed out Pritzker's budget and has bailed out Chicago. By contrast,
you're talking about the stimulus, the avalanche, two avalanches of stimulus money.
Yeah. Another $1.8 billion on top of the $1.2 billion already secured. But let me just discuss the contract for a second. It's really two contracts in one. You know, the massive contract, and your reporting was, as usual, right on target on everything. It does cost in excess of $600 million. But for an eight-year contract, that's not necessarily a very expensive contract. Look at the teachers union contract at $1.5 billion for 5 years. Yes, the teachers union membership is much larger, but still. So remember, this is two contracts. So that's my first point. My second point is that the retro, the $350 million in retro, the city has been putting money away, not all the money that they need, but they have been putting a good portion of that money away.
You said less than half.
Well, I estimate less than half. The city's claiming that they've allocated more than half. Of course, getting numbers from the city is not always the easiest proposition, but given the fact that it is a retro, the retro pay lends itself to having one-time money. So, for example, that $350 million retro pay is not a fixed cost. You see, going forward, the fixed cost is probably close to $275, $300 million. But the retro pay in itself is not a fixed cost. And obviously, the city has gotten one-time COVID money, a substantial amount of COVID money on top of the money that they've already received. So, you know, with the right budget prioritization and the right budget itemization, I think they could comfortably address the retro issue without building any long-term permanent costs into the budget, because once again, it is a four-year retro pay. They're paying them money that they have already owed them.
So are you indicating that between the stimulus money and the savings from refinancing that they can pay for the retro?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Are they planning to scoop and toss any of this new borrowing, meaning extending the debt out longer to a new generation of taxpayers?
I always felt that they didn't need to scoop and toss. I felt during the Rahm Emanuel administration, they could have gotten rid of scoop and toss a lot earlier. But to get into a discussion of what they're not doing and what they should be doing on the budget side is going to take more than this 30-minute podcast and may result in me being accused of trying to grandstand or elevate my profile. As you remember, last time I commented publicly on the budget.
Yeah, you were right too. And who cares what she says about that? You turned out to be right.
Yeah,
she put her head in the sand for the longest time about the impact of the pandemic on the city budget. And finally, she admitted that she had like a $2 billion deficit over 2 years. But getting back to the police contract, do you think that they intend to scoop and toss while doing some of this refinancing, and should they need to?
They should not need to do the scoop and toss to finance the police contract. There's no reason for them to do that. If they do scoop and toss, it'll be for a lot of other reasons. Remember, as you have pointed out time and again, they already have $900 million in scoop and toss that they have to, in other words, to a layman, they've already deferred $900 million in debt payments that they're going to have to make due. And I think they're going to use a lot of the stimulus money to do that. And it's hard to say just how big their structural deficit will be, which will, of course, now include the contract settlement. So it's hard to say. I mean, would that be close to an equal amount? I can't tell you because, not even the budget committee seems to get solid numbers these days. The administration, like past administrations, is not too transparent in putting out is putting out the figures and giving the being transparent about the numbers so you can really kind of assess and evaluate what's going on. So I can't answer that question. She shouldn't have to be able to do it. If she does it, if she scoops and tosses, it'll be for other reasons. It'll be for other problems with the budget.
The mayor and always outspoken FOP President John Catanzara have literally been at loggerheads on all matters pertaining to law enforcement. They're both pretty unyielding. Did that personality clash, the fact in some ways that they're alike, drag this out, do you think?
You know, that might have been part of it, but I've been involved in the negotiations since October, and the mayor's negotiations were in the very capable hands of Jim Francik. And as you know, Fran, I negotiated contracts with Francik. Francik was my negotiator when I was city budget director. And of course, I negotiated my two teacher union contracts on time with Jim Francik. So the mayor's team was uniformly excellent. And we had very constructive negotiations. Now, you know, we had the major negotiations, the annual, the scheduled negotiations, which could sometimes descend into theatrics behind the scenes. I mean, behind closed doors. But what John had me do was John had me in constantly contact and being and interact with Jim Francik when we weren't having our regular sessions to resolve issues. So, I mean, I must have exchanged 100 emails with the city and had close to 200 calls. So what we would do is we would try to resolve the sticky issues. I would try to get a sense of how far the city could go. And I would have a sense of how far John could go. So we were, you know, the whole idea that the FOP was resisting and that they were, you know, because on a number of occasions, the mayor made that accusation. We were constantly negotiating and we were literally talking, if not every day, at least every other day. And so it was one of the most enjoyable negotiations I had. I think the contract is extremely, extremely responsible financially. Look at the contract going forward. The pay increases going forward are reasonable given the city's financial crisis over the next 3.5 years, over the next 3.5 years after the retro pay. The retro pay will boost salaries 10.5%. That's comparable to what obviously the firefighters got. And going forward, it's another 9.5% over 3.5 years. That is not unreasonable given, certainly not unreasonable given inflation, but it's certainly not unreasonable from a financial standpoint. And that may set the benchmark for the other city contract negotiations. So it's
now you've argued that this should not increase taxes and it also should not delay the filling of police vacancies, which, by the way, is saying something considering how many Chicago police officers have been retired and been retiring, more retirements the first half of this year than in all of 2018. More retirements are certain to follow once this contract is ratified by the rank and file in the city council. Don't you agree?
You know, possibly that could happen. On the other hand, I submit to you that the failure to negotiate a contract hasn't slowed retirements whatsoever. On the flip side, the demoralization of the police department, not only because of the 12-hour days, to going 2 weeks without a day off and canceled days off, the fact that many sergeants have to work double shifts because they have a severe shortage of sergeants. I posted about the 11th district last weekend on a Sunday, not having a single sergeant. The elect and maybe half the cars with officers to cover their beats, despite the fact that the 11th district is the most violent district in the city. I think there were 4 deaths and 17 shootings last week. So clearly, you know, I think the lack of a contract on top of all those things is compounding the problems. I also want to talk from a financial standpoint. The amount of money, the tremendous amount of money that they're paying in overtime, anything they're saving by not filling police vacancies, they're more than paying in overtime. I never paid more than $35 million in overtime. And even if you adjust the $35 million by inflation, I think it was $55 million during my period as budget director for police overtime. What are they going to pay this year? $200 million, Fran, or more? So they're paying time and a half. And obviously with the contract and the increase in pays, the cost for overtime is even going to go greater. So the longer they delay in filling vacancies, at the end of the day, any dollar savings is going to be offset by the amount of money that they're paying in overtime, and they're going to pay the price in exhausted, demoralized police officers. these schedules are also having a real impact on police officer families. Remember, these are officers who have families, who have many, most of them have children at home. And so it's certainly creating stressful situations.
Is that why the police officers are retiring in droves? Or do they feel just hung out to dry and that the city doesn't have their back?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's the schedule is absolutely exhausting. I think the schedule is the primary reason. I mean, when you have police officers working 12 hours and you're not filling the vacancies, you're canceling days off, you get tired cops, you get less effective cops. And when you're not filling supervisor vacancies, you get too many officers who are unsupervised and don't have the backup. It's amazing that they've done the job that they've done and that they've exercised the restraint that they've exercised, given that lack of supervision, which incidentally was one of the consent decree mandates. And obviously those exhausting days. So I think that's that may be the primary reason, but certainly the feeling that there's a lack of public support out there, and that the state legislature passed legislation which is more about protecting criminals and in some cases about criminalizing police officers not following certain rules or certain procedures. I think those things in combination are driving them out.
The union agreed to the basic accountability measures that the supervisors agreed to, ending the ban on investigation of anonymous complaints, which follows this state legislation you refer to, no longer allowing officers to change their stories after reviewing body cam video, eliminating a requirement that disciplinary records older than 5 years be destroyed, et cetera. But the more thorny accountability measures are left to possibly more negotiations and possibly arbitration. What's left to negotiate and how difficult will it be to get there?
Well, let me point out that the decision was to split the contract in two, was to first of all, address the financial issues, because as you've astutely pointed out, the city has a financial window to not only settle this contract, but also to stabilize its finances. And remember, the city also controls $2.6 billion in additional federal money going to the Chicago Public Schools. So it's just not the COVID money that they control. And the city provides a lot of subsidies for the schools. And I'm not suggesting or recommending things. What I'm saying is, though, that the city has a lot of financial latitude that will not be there 2 years from now. So I think those factors. So we wanted to settle the financial side, because had we waited and it's gone to arbitration, it might be 2 years before we have an arbitrator's decision. And by then, the money might be gone. So getting the financial issues, getting these guys paid, getting their boost in pay, the bump in pay, really important. Getting a contract stability, labor peace moving forward. Those things were all very important. But what the city wanted in return, and what the city and what I think the Sun-Times and the Tribune editorialized was for the FOP to agree to accountability provisions that the sergeants agreed to. And essentially, that's what you got. So we felt that by embracing the accountability provisions that the sergeants agreed to, which are consistent with the consent decree and do not violate the state law, that would be enough for obviously us to tackle the financial side. Now, as you pointed out, there are issues. The city still has issues have not been resolved. We have issues. The FOP has issues.
Let's talk about a couple of the unresolved things that still have to be resolved. What are they?
Well,
what does the union want? What does the city want?
Well, I can't speak to well to the accountability side, in part because most of my focus was on the financial side, and it would be better for John to identify what some of the things that the city is asking for on that side. I will give one example, though, that the mayor has been insisting that there be a provision in there that basically says police officers cannot work second jobs, secondary employment. And obviously, that's something that the union has resisted. So there's a lot of little things like that that the city's been demanding that the FLP was not going to agree to. So the thinking was, why should we delay everything else? Why don't we defer those discussions to the second part, the second half of this contract negotiation? Likewise, Fran, on the FLP side, the issue of retiree health care, those who are retiring and have those years when they're going to have to pay exorbitant increases in health care. That issue remains unresolved. We have some very specific ideas on how to address that. But we didn't want to go. Well, that's for another, between you and I, that's for another discussion. I'll be more than happy to have that discussion. It's just going to take me longer to do it justice. But we have some proposals out there that the city was receptive to, but they had issues with the budget office concerning about, those provisions putting much greater long-term debt on the city's books. So they were reluctant to do that. There are a lot of little things, little issues like that were just taking too long to settle. And then there are other issues like subcategories. You know, the fire department has a lot of categories for receiving mandated training in certain areas that are now required. And, you know, it's so one of the things that the FLP was pushing was for subcategory pay. If you're required to get certain certifications, you know, there's provisions in the contract, requiring officers be trained, to do life safety interventions. So the objective was to say, look, if we're going to be mandated with these additional certifications, so to speak, we should also receive additional compensation. Well, those issues were not going to get resolved right away, and they were in need of further negotiation. So the feeling was,
what about more compensation for police officers whose days off are summarily canceled over those who volunteer for overtime? How big an issue is that?
Well, let's just say that issue and other issues like that are left to be resolved. But the minute this contract is settled, the FLP and the city are going to begin negotiations again to address those issues. We just didn't want to get bogged down on those issues and delay this contract further. And as I mentioned, the longer you delay the contract, the less likely the city's going to be in a position to finance the contract. Now, one might argue, well, you know, are you kicking the can down the road? Not necessarily. It's important that we have the contract settled now so the city and its budget people, as well as the city council and their budget people, can now construct a budget that doesn't do other things at the expense of the cops, as has been done in the past. In other words, yes, we have this contract. We have to work it into the city's long-term budget plan. So in a nutshell, we wanted to get the major financial issues resolved. The city wanted to make sure that it got the accountability provisions that the sergeants that were negotiated and approved in the sergeant's contract, and then these other accountability issues that the city wanted to pursue, and these other financial issues and healthcare issues that the FOP wanted to pursue could be left to this second phase of the negotiation, which will begin right after this contract proposal has been finalized. Let me point out that some of these issues that are left on the table will probably go to arbitration. Most likely go to arbitration.
The mayor has recently acknowledged what we all know, and that is that Chicagoans, particularly those who live on the south and west sides, but really all over the city, are afraid for the crime. They're afraid to come out on a beautiful summer night and enjoy the night. Until she gets that under control, she admits, nothing else matters. So what needs to be done to get this unrelenting crime wave under control, Paul?
Well, I'll tell you one thing you need to get done is you need to get these schools open. You need to keep them open. Do not underestimate the degree to which having school campuses closed for 12 months has contributed to the spike in crime. The Tribune did this analysis of Crime Lab. University of Chicago Crime Lab, they do research. And basically, they pointed out that not only were 83 school-age children killed last year, 18 years and younger, and 567 shot, but the number of school-age children, this number that they put out was 17 and under, the number of arrests for murder in the 17 and under category last year was 8%. The number arrested for shootings was 9%. The number arrested for carjackings was 49%. For robberies was 32%. So we've seen this huge spike in violent crime against young people and in violent crime committed by young people. Do not underestimate the damage that was done by having these school campuses closed for 12 months. The fact that they're even debating or the negotiating over the reopening of the schools when they have a $9.54 billion budget, which incidentally is the equivalent to $26,700 per student, it's sinful. Clearly, the serious damage has been done to the city by the closing of schools. In contrast to other major cities that didn't feel the need to close their schools, or for that matter, the Archdiocese schools, which were not closed. They were proper. They were practicing proper medical, proper COVID mitigations with the masking and the social distancing. So that was a big part of it. There is no substitute for making the type of investments in the community that can be transformational. For example, what is the city doing to use the COVID money to provide adult ed occupational training and job placement for not only the chronically unemployed, but those previously incarcerated who are being released and being sent back into the communities? I mean, how is the city spending the TIF money to make the type of investments in businesses on the South and West Side? The real investments, I'm not talking about, you know, these little spotty investments that they make that they much publicize. I mean, what are they doing? What are they doing to reopen the mental health centers? I mean, the mental health centers, the cost of reopening those centers are a fraction of the budget. I mean, it was silly that Rahm and Daley before him even closed centers when you consider just what a fraction of the cost of the budget the centers that the city incurred for having these centers open. Let me also point out that the COVID money, one of the specific uses for COVID money is to deal with mental health issues. So there's a lot of things that they can do on that side, but there is no substitute there for making sure that you have enough cops and that you have enough cops in the districts. The 10 most violent districts in the city have lost anywhere between 75 and 175 officers as part of this massive reorganization that pulled 1,000 officers and made them part of these citywide units. And then with the shortage, even more officers are being pulled to work overtime, to work double time and double shifts because of the shortages everywhere else. So at the end of the day, filling these vacancies, and I've suggested that they go out and they invite back and they incentivize to return retired police officers with supervisory experience, retired supervisors, as well as retired police officers with detectives experience, with investigatory experience, so that they can come in and begin to supplement the ranks while they fill these vacancies. They should also stop making excuses that COVID has impeded their ability to have large classes, to train the police officers, because the police can literally command. I mean, they could be training people in the United Center if they need to. The Jerry Reinsdorf would give them the United Center to do training if they needed to space people out. So they could easily run not one class, Fran, but they could run two classes, a day shift and a night shift to begin.
But the mayor is shrinking the department. She eliminated 650 police vacancies in the last budget. So she's going in the opposite direction.
Well, they're certainly going in the opposite direction, but the loss of positions is compounded by the fact that they have 1,000 vacancies they haven't filled. Cantazzaro looked at statistics I think there are
you're talking about 1,000 on the shrunken number. 1,000 fewer than the shrunken number.
Well, there's 1,000 positions that are not. These are positions on the books. I mean, let's start by filling the vacancies that are there, and then we can talk about how to add additional cops. Also, I think the number is 143 sergeant positions that have not been filled too. And, you know, so that's also critically important. So two things. Yes, she took 614 positions out of the budget, but the fact that they've got
640, I believe it is.
Was it? Well, yeah. But the fact that they haven't filled 1,000 vacancies the last time I looked, and the fact and compounding that problem, the fact that they've pulled over 1,000 officers from the local beats and they put them in these citywide units, that's compounding the problem. So it's just not only the reduction of the positions, it's the failure to fill positions and the stripping of officers from local police districts. That includes high crime districts. The 10 highest crime districts in the city have had anywhere from 75 to 175 of their officers, their beat officers, pulled. I think that's disaster. I think the management, the mismanagement of that department and the misuse of the resources is making things far worse, is doing far more damage than the damage being done by the elimination of the 640 positions.
So you're saying David Brown needs to go? He's not up to the job?
Well, you know, she's got to make some decisions, because I don't see I'm beginning to think that there really isn't a strategy. You know, is it a bad strategy or is there no strategy at all? And they seem to be grabbing at straws. Just the latest case in point was the so-called platoons, you know, the anti-gun platoons, where they were pulling officers and they were going to have like these four platoons. All they were doing were pulling officers from other, like from the narcotics division and stuff like that. And in fact, they were pulling some officers from the training academies to work in these platoons. I mean, why did they get rid of the area support teams in the first place? You know what the area support teams were? The area support teams were gang, gun, and drug teams that worked areas that worked certain areas of the city to support individual districts. So you not only had the beat cops, but you had these area support teams that could deploy resources to support the local beat cops, to support the local districts. I mean, why did you get rid of that in the first place?
Before we go, the mayor raised eyebrows this week when she said that running for a second term is not a gimme, and she cracked the door open to joining the mayor of Atlanta and saying that one term is enough. What'd you make of that, and are you considering running for mayor again?
Let me answer the second question first. You know, I've been posting on these issues since the election. In fact, I've been talking about the same things I'm talking about now. I was talking about during the campaign. So I'm doing these things, not that I'm planning on running. I'm doing these things.
But are you giving any thought to it?
No, you know, you never say never to anything. But no, I'm not right now. It's way too early to decide whether or not I'd consider doing something like that. So
is life a deserved re-election? Has she earned it?
Well, look, she's got 2 years to straighten things out. She's got the COVID money, which is going to give her an opportunity. She's got to make some decisions on the public safety side, because clearly, the present leadership of the police department is totally inadequate. They are not doing the job, and their mismanagement or I should say their ineffective use of resources is just compounding the problem. There's no substitution for real community policing, for beat integrity, for supporting the local districts. And I think the whole city is suffering as a result of that. But there is a window of opportunity here for the mayor. The schools have received a substantial amount of money. They got to stop playing games and get those schools open and keep those schools open so we can get the kids engaged. There's a lot of things that they can do on that side. For example, like why not take a page out of Crystal Ray, the Jesuit work study high school, where these older high school kids are not only going to high school, but they're getting opportunities to get involved in work study jobs, paid work study jobs, in lieu of, non-essential electives, which would allow them to to get engaged, allow them to be exposed to role models in the community, would be able to give them their first employment opportunities. There's a lot of creative things that can be done. So with the massive amount of COVID money coming in, there's still opportunities for her to recover. We'll just have to see what happens.
And Jose Torres, the interim CEO of CPS, said that his priority is re-engaging 100,000 students over the next month who are at risk, he believes, of leaving the system because of the pandemic, which is really quite the statement when you consider that they lost 15,000 students last year and that they are now serving 60,000 students fewer than just 7 years ago. When you and Gary Chico were running the schools, I believe it was 430,000 or thereabouts. Now it's 340,000. Unbelievable.
Fran, they have their lowest enrollment. I like to say they have their lowest enrollment since the Germans were invading France through Holland. And I'm not talking about World War II. I'm talking about World War I, 1914. They've lost enrollment for 17 consecutive years. And there are 100,000 fewer students in the Chicago public schools now than they were when Chico and I were there. And let me point out that during our 6 years, enrollment grew by almost 40,000 students. So, you know, they can do things to get the schools back on track, but you know, the CTU has done serious, serious damage to the city. And unfortunately, if unchecked, they'll continue to do damage. The caving to them, to their threats of striking, and they would have been illegal strikes, three times when they didn't open schools in September, and then they delayed opening schools in November, and then they delayed opening high schools until April. I mean, that was just unconscionable. When you have power, you use it. They did not use that power. And as a result, unlike many, many other districts, the kids were not in school. Serious damage was done. But, you know, a lot can happen in 2 years. Hopefully they'll start to get their act together.
And the union now has more power granted to them by the General Assembly. Paul Vallis, thank you for joining us. And we will watch and see whether the mayor can turn this around, whether David Brown can turn this around, and what happens in the next more contentious round of negotiations with the FOP. And we will see you all next week.
Thank you.